Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, everybody. Assalamu alaikum, our listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Middle West podcast. As you can see, I'm not Thaqif Musa. I am Mustafa. I will be your guest host for today, joined by my by Thaqif. He's taking a back seat today. He's decided to
Assalamu alaikum.
relinquish
Peace be
control.
upon you all.
We are also joined with Yasmin Adam. She was with us for a few episodes. She's joining us today for this one.
Assalamu alaikum, guys.
Assalamu alaikum, Yasmin, and obviously our very special guest, Ambassador Mohammed Shakir Bey, who is the former ambassador to the United Nations for Bosnia and Herzegovina and the former Minister of Foreign Affairs for Bosnia as well. He is now currently a diplomat, a businessman, and a university lecturer. So, inshallah, wa alaikum assalam. Inshallah, when we get to the ambassador, if I've missed anything out, feel free to add it there. Today's episode is about a very, very special topic, a topic that's very close to my heart and very close to a lot of our listeners' hearts. It's about Srebrenica Memorial Day. Now, this is to commemorate the Srebrenica genocide, where over 8,000 Bosniak Muslim men and boys were systematically murdered in cold blood by the Serbian forces. But it's also to remember the victims of the wider conflict. I think what people tend to do is to focus specifically on Srebrenica and forget that tens of thousands, if not nearly hundreds of thousands, of people were affected by the conflict in Bosnia. So without further ado, I will hand it over to our very special guest. And maybe if you could give us a bit of historical context to the conflict. How did it start? How did it come about? Did the Bosniak Muslims just wake up one day and find themselves persecuted? And maybe if we...
Well, salam alaikum again. And maybe it's best if I leave the historical context just a little bit later. And the reason is that I don't wish to paint this just in the context of a historical cause. But maybe the proper... historical perspective here is that for a long time, I think many of us, including myself, thought of the conflict in Bosnia and Herzegovina, the war, the genocide, as being the last conflict of the 20th century. But in fact, I'm convinced now it was the first conflict of the 21st century. As we all know, Sarajevo was the spark. The assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand was the spark that set off World War I. I think when we look at the various crimes and wars that have been initiated by everything from ISIS to Vladimir Putin to the killers in Norway and the attack on the mosque in New Zealand, all of these people have either garnered initiative or inspiration or some sort of greater strategic perspective from what happened in Bosnia. But let me now go back to Bosnia and Herzegovina as a whole. I'm going to speak a lot of Srebrenica, and Srebrenica deserves a lot of attention. But actually, in terms of numbers, it was one of the, let's use the term, not largest of the genocides committed. The reason Srebrenica is spoken of so much is because it happened under the eye of the United Nations, NATO, and in fact, I have contended and now have been proven accurate on the acquiescence, even complicity of certain powers. But we have, for example, a town called Prijedor, where over 30,000, not just men, but women, young children, toddlers, were murdered in front of their homes and buried immediately there in mass graves. Most of these were Bosnian Muslims, but in many instances, they were also Bosnian Croats, that is Catholics. And even in instances, Bosnian Serbs who were loyal to the government were murdered by the extremist Serbs. I always am very careful here not to generalize and blame quote unquote Serbs. I blame those who are responsible directly, or who led the crimes on the ground, or who led the political initiatives that in some way enabled the crimes. And the crimes really did not have a religious motivation. They had a religious character where religion was used as a weapon. So Muslims in particular, but also sometimes the Croats, were identified as the enemy on the basis of their religion or their ethnicity. But as I mentioned, Serbs were also murdered. And the reason the Serbs were murdered here was the same reason they were murdered during the rise of Hitler, because it was important to eliminate any opposition to the ultranationalist Serbs, because the worst enemy for many of these ultranationalist Serbs was the enemy from within. So they needed to be themselves murdered and made an example of. And sometimes the Western world played into this identification of the enemy or the target, the victim, in religious terms. Number one, because it was easy. It was easy to say, oh, Muslims really don't seem to belong in Europe, so there must be a reason why they're being identified, or because it fit into their bias, implicit or explicit bias, or because in some way it rationalized their non-action. Action not to save Muslims seems to be sometimes easier to justify, but it also is much more openly, if you speak of a civil war. And I use the word here, civil war, not because we use it, but because sometimes Western powers use it, then it is easier. It is easier to speak of why you don't act, because in a civil war, presumably everyone is guilty. Everyone has some accountability. Everyone has some blood on their hands. And I must say, as the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina, we had many non-Muslims, including Serbs, Croats, Jews, and non-believers of any sort in our government, in our military. Some of the most important defenders of Bosnia were non-Muslim. And we, to the end of the war, maintained this strong identity of a multi-ethnic, multi-religious state. And it was only by the nature of the Dayton Peace Agreement, which we'll get into, that Bosnia becomes ever more identified and verticalized, almost stratified on religious terms. Again, because that's what the Serbian nationalists wanted. That's even what the Serbian, the Croat nationalists wanted. And that's what the Western powers in many ways wanted, because it rationalized their inaction for 4 to 5 years.
So, I wanted to ask a quick question about that. About that inaction. So one of the things that I found very interesting was some of these numbers, because Srebrenica is remembered and is kind of a something that a lot of people come around, because the numbers were, you know, 10,000 people in quick succession in just a number of days. Do you think at the time, and again, was this released immediately? Because some of the articles and some of the records I've got that are out there of, like, people, for example, Richard Holbrooke, who was one of the negotiators from the American side, did they know that this was happening? And the numbers, did they know immediately that this is the amount of civilian deaths that are happening? Or was it a case of not enough information getting out, or even false information getting out? Because there was some kind of playing of the media where the people perpetrating the murders or some of the attacks were actually either withholding information or putting out false information as well. So do you think it was a case of it was completely intentional that they wanted to look the other way, or was it that maybe some of the international community just didn't know what was happening?
You're being too kind. And I consider myself a secular person. So I do not speak with the zeal of a very religious Muslim person. I speak with the perspective of a global citizen. And the Bosnians were betrayed by those powers very much, who had an obligation not only towards Srebrenica and Bosnia, more specifically, but in particular other global citizens who undertook a commitment. So first of all, it became very clear soon thereafter that mass killings were happening. And it came mainly from two sources, slightly a third. The first source was actually the Dutch peacekeepers themselves, who actually were not in on the secret deal to betray Srebrenica, and I'll come back to that. The Dutch themselves did not behave heroically, and they suffered many consequences, including their government. And those consequences continue to this day, including psychological disorders and suicides of the soldiers that were there. Over 20-some of the Dutch peacekeepers committed suicide. I believe there's two of them living in the hills above Srebrenica, still traumatized by the event. So they
just to interject here in terms of the Dutch peacekeeping force, just to give a bit of background to our listeners.
Let me come back to that because there's a lot of material here that tends to come together. So I'll come back to that and feel free to interject, but I'm trying to give it some order here so that we can kind of come to the perspective of why this happened. And I was foreign minister at the time, and it happened under my watch. So that's one of the reasons why I keep speaking about it, because it continues to be my responsibility. One thing I neglected to say is that one of the reasons that the issue of Srebrenica remains alive is not only because I speak of it and because it happened under the watch of the UN and NATO, but also because the mothers of Srebrenica and other family members have been so persistent. So I need to give them credit. But why was Srebrenica betrayed? How was it betrayed? So the second knowledge of what was happening actually came from the United States, or United States source, and that was Madeleine Albright, who was the UN ambassador, and who immediately started disclosing evidence on satellite photographs. Why did she do this? Because she knew there was a deal. I know she was opposed to the deal. She'll never admit to it that there was or she was opposed to it, because now she's lumped in to that whole team of Holbrook and company. And the third source was just a little bit coming from our sources. But as soon as events started unfolding, I was on the phone with President Izetbegovic. And he felt more certain that things were not as bad as I was, because he had no contact with what was going on in Srebrenica. So my contacts were coming from the Dutch and from UN/American sources. So very quickly, the information started to come out. And what was my job? My job was to try to save lives at that time. So to try to prevent any further killing if there was killing going on, and most importantly, to secure the evacuation of the civilians that were left in the so-called UN protected zone of Srebrenica. And here I will now bring the role of the Dutch in. The Dutch were put into Srebrenica, replacing the French several months before Srebrenica fell. Did the French know that something was going to happen under Mitterrand? And Mitterrand deserves special blame, the president of France at that time. I believe so. But I will come back to that story later as well, because these stories get
He was also the one who made the statement about a Muslim state in Europe not really belonging.
Yes, but there's it's much worse than that again. You're being too kind again. Sometimes
we've got you here, Ambassador, to give us the unfiltered facts and realities.
Yes.
Because obviously reading about it.
Remember, I call myself a secular
of
person.
Course, of
and
course.
What happens is that sometimes people who consider themselves to be more Muslim or religiously oriented, they're accustomed to constantly being slapped back on these issues, that somehow you want to come across as being reasonable. And in this case, there is no reasonable. Srebrenica was betrayed. Now, the only thing that we can argue was this level of killing foreseen? And the answer is maybe it was not planned, but it should have been foreseen, because the person who was in command of or given the right, in effect, the opportunity over on Srebrenica, had been doing the murders all along. He was the commander of the ultra-nationalist Serbian forces, General Mladic, all along. He was the commander of the paramilitaries who had committed so many crimes, including against women and children. So in other words, if you didn't get a message from him that said, I will do this killing, you should have known that he would. Because in effect, he is like a serial killer. He is one that once he's let loose, he cannot resist. He's a psychotic personality. And you will see this from his ongoing trial. So come back to the role of the Dutch. I had a very good working relationship with the Dutch. And when they took over, we started communicating about what the situation was like in Srebrenica. And the first thing that we started finding out that was a problem is when the Dutch troops would leave Srebrenica on leave, they would not be allowed to come back. So the Dutch troops were being slowly reduced. Number two, when they when food or medicines would be sent in, it would be sent in such limited quantities that would only be enough for the soldiers, nothing left over for the people. So the people, the citizens of Srebrenica, were suffering from severe hunger, and even things like iodine deprivation, all sorts of physical medical issues from the lack of adequate diet and medicines. There was also no gasoline going in to even supply the Dutch military convoys. And the Serbians in part did this to try to pit the Dutch population against the citizens against the Dutch peace battalion. And before Srebrenica fell, like many of the UN protected zones, where the local population was deprived of most of the weapons to protect itself, there were so-called outposts, UN outposts, to monitor the situation and monitor any violations and potentially incoming attacks. And the Dutch, for several weeks before then, had to withdraw from these outposts because those outposts came under attack. And then the Dutch drew further and further into the pocket. So we knew an attack was coming.
But they were doing a, they were essentially, there were a lot of refugees and civilians from around the area coming in. Yeah.
And it's then kind of, and so the pocket this is, was not,
this is the point, this is the point I wanted to jump in on, and, Ambassador. I mean, this is the point that I wanted to jump in, Ambassador. So with Srebrenica, was it strictly the citizens of?
No, it was the area around Srebrenica had been ethnically cleansed. And
refugees were being kettled.
Yes. And in fact, at one time, I had organized with the help of the United States Pentagon an airdrop to try to feed these people. And the Pentagon provided those foods. The problem was, the Serbians, after a while, under the control of Belgrade, had established anti-aircraft weapons throughout that zone. So even an airdrop became more difficult. So the only thing that could break that ever-tightening noose was an airstrike, military aircraft that were, in fact, designed to break that type of strangulation and evade that type of anti-aircraft, which we think came from the Russians, but it may have come even from the Chinese. We don't know. I think the Americans do know a little bit more about it, and that's why a few years later, I believe there was an attack on the Chinese embassy compound by American jets when the U.S. and NATO in 1998-1999 intervened in the situation of Kosovo, which happened four years later, in effect, after Srebrenica. I'll come back to that issue.
Yeah, we'll come to Kosovo because I think there's a lot about where it kind of impacted. I wanted to bring it back to your role particularly in terms of you were protecting kind of civilian life. And I think you mentioned this, that a lot of the times when we think of the Bosnia side, the Bosnia-Herzegovina side of the conflict, we think of it as the Bosniak Muslims only. But actually, you were trying to protect life for not just Bosnian Muslims. You also were trying to protect Croatian Catholics and even some Serbians. And some of the crimes
let me just make sure I even interject there. I was protecting all innocent civilians.
All innocent life. Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't matter on which side.
Where they are.
People caught on the wrong. And that was one of the motivations for signing the peace agreement in Dayton, is to stop a war where many innocent people were being dragged in by particularly these Serbian extremists, sometimes Croat extremists, and sometimes even Muslim extremists.
Yeah,
because we were being made into the battleground that we see today in Syria, or that we see in other places. And we avoided that. And we see how badly Syria has turned out.
I think Ali Izetbegović, the president, he said at the time that this is not a just peace, but my people do need peace.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't agree with that peace except for that reason. And it is peace, and it is the cessation of hostilities that makes those who want to promote free and democratic society stronger. The fascists, the ultranationalists, the religious bigots, they're strongest in the context of conflict because they try to make all people who are like them religiously or ethnically, they try to make them complicit. Hitler made all German people complicit, except those that resisted. Yeah. So it was the same role of Milosevic, Karadzic, and Mladic, the three Serbian leaders of the time. They tried to make the Serb people all complicit. And I consider some of the bravest and most principled people in the former Yugoslavia to be those Serbs, including in Serbia, who withstood that type of assault upon their conscience, upon their intellect, upon their morality, their ethics, and their soul. Let me interject here with a story so that you understand that it was not just Milosevic, Mladic, and Karadzic who played into this role. In 1994, Dr. Haris Ilajic, who was the foreign minister at the time, actually prime minister by then, I was the ambassador to the UN, and our ambassador to France, we went to see François Mitterrand in the spring of 1994, because one of the enclaves, another enclave, Gorazda, was under severe attack. And we actually received an audience with him in his private residence. I believe it was on a Sunday midday. And the question immediately as we met with him was, he was dressed very casually. He seemed to be very relaxed. We heard a French dog barking in the background. How did I know he was French? Of course, it was my bias. It was my prejudice. So I'm not sure it was a French dog, but it was a dog. And anyway, as soon as François Mitterrand walked in, the prime minister started speaking of the problem in Gorazda and how something urgently needed to be done. And he only spoke for about 30, 40 seconds, and Mitterrand interrupted him. And he said, it's all your Muslims' fault. And he didn't say, it's your Bosnians' fault, it's your government. He said, it's all your Muslims' fault. And he then kept on laying the blame upon, quote unquote, the Muslims. And Dr. Silajic, our prime minister, was a little taken back, which usually doesn't happen easily. And I immediately stepped in and said, President Mitterrand, with all due respect, you're wrong about whose fault it is. And more importantly than that, I'm here, and we are here on behalf of all the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which represents all the people of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And by the way, did you know that the ambassador to Paris, to your country, was a Bosnian Serb? His name was Nikola Kovac. He was a very genteel, academic individual. And Mitterrand looked at our ambassador and said to him, is this true? And Ambassador Kovacs started to explain and started to say why he was on the side of the government. And Mitterrand looked at him and he said, you are a traitor to your people.
Oh, wow.
Meaning to the Serb people. So this perspective...
So they were actively the French... Well, I say the French because it was their, head of state, was actively propagating this, the division within the Bosnian community. He was, you know, he was turning around to an ambassador and telling him, you're betraying your people, when he's in fact there trying to represent his people, which I think one of the cases that that we were reading upon, I think Yasmin brought it to our attention, was the forced pregnancies or the forced rapes. I think Yasmin brought it up when we were doing the preparation. So I think maybe she's got a bit she's got a bit more knowledge of it than I. So what was the exact thing that you were telling us, Yasmin?
I had studied the case of Bosnia during university when we were discussing it in the context of transitional justice. And one of the things that stood out was gender-based violence, and particularly towards women and girls that had been raped. And it was this idea of, there was these enforced pregnancies, and there was this idea that once the war was over, these women were given a choice. So a choice of, some women had chosen to keep the babies that they were raped with, and some had chosen to abort it. But the main idea was that was about this choice. And so I guess the question behind that is, you know, how were the soldiers, because before the war these were their neighbors, these were their friends, everyone was together in a sense. How were they motivated to start killing their own neighbors, their own friends? I mean, when you go to Srebrenica Memorial, you can still see the racist graffiti, and you still see this notion of a greater Serbia. So yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, let me just get into this issue of enforced pregnancy a little bit deeper. But to answer your last question, it wasn't that difficult to get the masses involved in the mass killings and perpetration of crimes. Because as I said, most had either a choice to be perpetrators or to be murdered themselves. So that is one of the horrible things about ultranationalism and fascism. It either makes you complicit or it makes you dead. And one of the situations that is most effective in making you complicit is invoking religion, nationalism, identity, or just fear. So if you're killing someone in the name of God, in the name of your own country, and because, of course, you're told to fear the other, it's not that difficult to get most of the so-called followers, the people who have the mentality of a follower, to become part of the gang, because they understand implicitly that if they don't engage, that they will themselves become victims. And sometimes in order to rationalize this, they become even more vicious. Because, of course, they're attacking a friend, a neighbor. So they really have to somehow get themselves to believe this, to get themselves worked up. And here I'll just interject one other view, and which is that, unfortunately, in the DNA of all of our monotheistic religions is the story of Jericho. And for those who don't know it, it's an Old Testament story where, according to the Old Testament, God ordered not only the conquest of Jericho, but the murder of all of its inhabitants, including its women and children. So even within our religious philosophy, unfortunately, we have this DNA. And that's one of the reasons I think those who are of a more religious perspective, they have to somehow work this out of our religious DNA. We cannot say that somehow because they did it to us, we can do it to them. That is an appropriate response. Now, getting to the issue of enforced pregnancy and gender-based crime.
Yeah. Sorry, I'll come back to a separate conversation, so maybe we'll come back to that. But yeah, please continue.
Yasmin is coming back to a... Well, Yasmin's point deserves a lot of focus because it goes way beyond Bosnia. But please, come on in if you want to come, because I'm provoking certain issues, but that's the way it should be. It shouldn't be you just provoking me. I should be provoking you and your audience. So please go ahead.
Sorry, I wanted to talk about some of the faith-based aspects, but also bring in the fact that I think you mentioned a few points about how the people were conditioned to do this from a kind of nationalistic, great Serbian ideal that Radovan Karadzic and Mladic, as well as the president, all of them, kind of they were pushing this idea that you need to fight for your identity and kind of you're a race traitor if you don't, which kind of led to people killing their neighbors. But also there was something that happened before it, which led to all of these Serbians being in positions of power. So they played it strategically so that these guys would be the ones in power. I think the point you made about monotheistic religions and that, I think that'll be, maybe we can have you on for a separate podcast where we can talk about that, because I think we'll go off a lot. But definitely, yeah. I think that Yasmin's point that you were about to address is very important. So I think kind of how were they motivated to do something so terrible, where not only did they rape these innocent women in front of them who were part of the very same community or neighbors or friends, but also kind of forced them to keep those pregnancies and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I consider some of my greatest contributions as a diplomat and as someone who signed the International Criminal Court Treaty, the Rome Statute, to have been related to the role of women and gender-based crimes and conflict. So I'll get a little bit into that issue because I think it has a much broader application here. What we found out relatively early on in the conflict, that women were being held, not just rape, but being held in rape camps. So the idea is that they would be raped repeatedly. But then, in addition to that, the thinking of the Serbian ultranationalists was that if we force these women not only to obviously be subjected to sexual assault, but then to carry babies to birth, that quote-unquote these women would be giving birth to Serb babies, and that somehow this would be even a greater insult and another way to in effect inflict genocide. By the way, rape is one of the ways that you can inflict genocide according to the so-called Genocide Convention, which I'll come back to also later. And the first question was to draw parallel
between.
You're breaking up, actually, so I'm not getting your question.
I think Mustafa's frozen. I think what he's trying to say is to draw parallels to the way rape has been weaponized in other conflicts globally. So we've seen it.
Let's stop it right there. There was never a consideration of rape as a crime in other conflicts, except in one situation, not in a situation of World War II at all. No Nazis were ever tried for systematic crimes against women. The only situation never happened before then was the case of Korean comfort women that were raped and held by the Japanese Imperial Army during the World War II. That was the only situation. Before then, women were kind of considered the coincidental victims of conflict. And this is the first time that we said, no, this is not coincidental. They are the targets.
Yeah.
Whatever the thinking behind targeting them, the perpetrator, in fact, has targeted them. And it was very then important how we responded. And the first thing we had to do was to empower the women. We could not just leave them feeling that they were victims or even just subject to some sort of recourse that would be put out there by men. So the first thing is that we pressed ahead with the notion, the number one, the woman had a choice, whatever the situation may be. Number two, if she chose to give birth to these babies or obviously couldn't have an abortion, these babies, in fact, were not somehow defective. They were not sir babies. They were not. They were just innocent children, and they deserve to be viewed on their own for whatever they would be in the future. So in some instances, the babies were given up for adoption that were born. In some instances, they were raised by the family and told who they were afterwards. And in some instances, they were never told. So now we find out that many of these young men and women are growing up. And we find out that really they're not defective. What they may be lacking is obviously this confusion that might have existed within the family or even their own identity. But as I think God would want us to see, innocent is innocent. Yeah. And at the same time, we empowered the women to make the choice because they were the ones who were put into this situation. And we, and I particularly was strong, to use one of Donald Trump's words, in pressing ahead with the notion that the women were also warriors in this fight, and they were just not somehow left behind to be passive victims. So when it came time to negotiate several years after that in 1998, the International Criminal Court and the so-called Rome Statute, I will tell a little bit of a longer story, but this would be Bosnia and Herzegovina was instrumental, was decisive in making sure that there would be a set of crimes defined as gender-based crimes, which now gives birth to this whole notion of women's rights. And to some extent, if we want to call it that, whatever it may mean, the Me Too movement. How were we decisive? First of all, I was the head of the Bosnian delegation to these negotiations, having been instrumental in establishing the criminal tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, having been so relevant to the work of that tribunal and the preparations. I was the vice chairman of the preparatory committee for the International Criminal Court. But what we did was we brought together a large group of young international legal experts, including women and men. We worked actually with a group called No Peace Without Justice, which is based out of Italy. Emma Bonino, a former Minister of Foreign of Affairs in the European Union, was one who started that. And I had a representative from our team, about 20 members, in each of these various subcommittees. And one of these subcommittees was deciding what's a crime. So we ended up in a funny situation where countries like Saudi Arabia and the Vatican did not wish to have anything called gender-based crimes. Each one of those groups with large supporting casts from the, let me use the word, Wahhabi-based countries, not including Iran, by the way, the Wahhabi-based countries, and then with the Vatican,
when you say that, Latin American countries, kind of the Gulf
yes,
state.
But I'm speaking generally because there was this notion that this idea of somehow gender-based crimes and women's empowerment would promote a certain sexual promiscuity, maybe abortion. I don't know exactly how they were rationalizing this in their own mind. And we said, wait a second. We just went through this. And there were Muslim women and Catholic women who were subjected to mass rapes and enforced pregnancy. So you're talking about some vague interpretation or possible interpretation of this statute. And I'm talking to you about what happened in recent history then. And we must do something to protect these women. And that's how we ended up with this specific provision on gender-based crimes. And we wanted to make sure that women were empowered within that. And remember, empowering doesn't mean you have an abortion. That's your option. But you're more likely to see yourself as someone who has the right to abort or the right to have the baby, the right to testify, the right to be seen as a leader in your own society, the right to be seen as a fighter for your own society, if you are given that opportunity to be in court. And there were, by the way, women who were in combat. We had women in combat as well as in the government. But ordinary women coming from small towns or villages didn't have that opportunity. almost at the beginning of the war, many of them found themselves in this type of dreadful situation. And by the way, we see now, we've seen it in Myanmar, we've seen it in so many other situations where rape is used as a weapon of war. And that is, if I can speak for one moment personally, that is my proudest moment. That is my proudest achievement, because I have left a legacy and empowered another generation, including women. Because now, whatever that provision means, it allows yourselves, not just women, but men and women working together to define it and no longer ignore women and somehow deem that what happens at the end of a conflict is the fruits of victory. That's how it was defined. Women were viewed as the fruits of victory. And that is not something that is consistent with, I think, either our Islamic ideals or our modern ideals.
I think we've touched on the whole the aspect of, you know, the forced pregnancies, rape, you know, one of the, if not the most heinous crime or known to man. I think which draws me onto the one of the questions that we had prepared is that in one of the lectures that you've given, I think we were listening to on YouTube, you mentioned that the situation was so bleak in Bosnia that that you thought that your UN office would be the last enclave of Bosnia or the last remnant of Bosnia as a nation. I mean, obviously, we were too young to remember the conflict. Most of our listeners probably don't remember the conflict. But how bad was it truly? I mean, what we have in front of us now, we have the Syrian conflict, we have the Rohingya, we have the Palestinian conflict. How bad was it compared to some of the conflicts we can see, some of the conflicts we've experienced? Was it worse? Was it equally the same? Obviously, all conflicts are bad, but for it to become so bleak that, you know, that's how you felt at the time. How would you describe that?
Well, it was a genocidal war from the outset. Yeah. So it was not just a conflict. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the reason that genocide is not used for all of Bosnia is because this is another way of those who failed to intervene, who failed to even free the Bosnians to defend themselves. This is another way for them to try to evade responsibility. See, under the Genocide Convention, there's a affirmative, there's an obligation to intervene to stop the genocide. So, of course, countries like the United States, the UK, Russia, France, most democracies signed that treaty, but they didn't wish to jump in, and they did not wish to free the Bosnians to defend themselves. So
that caused the power imbalance? Was that part of the? Was that? It was part of the problem. But
let me put it to you this way: we were especially capable in defending ourselves because we had nowhere to retreat. There was no seat to retreat to. There were several pockets, in particularly Sarajevo, the city, which in the end was connected by a tunnel, a long tunnel, to other free areas. And that's how we brought in supplies into Sarajevo after the UN itself was actually forced to stop. We brought in the wounded. And my experience going through the tunnel on numerous occasions is one of those most memorable. I remember the people working the tunnel. They were like ghosts. They were white because they had been inside, because they used to push these mining cars back and forth with supplies, food, wounded. So it was blood. It was rotten flour and vegetables. It was very low. I walked through it and I knocked my head a couple of times on the beams that were meant to support it. But the people who manned the tunnel were heroic. I remember coming out of the tunnel on the other side, because sometimes we would export homemade weapons from outside the tunnel to the other side, and the people who would transport those weapons used to wear grenades around their neck. And the point was that if something blew up, they wanted to make sure they went. They didn't want to have just a partial loss, because there's a few times that I had to walk down toward the tunnel daylight and have mortars and sniping. So it was a deadly, deadly situation. But before then, at the beginning of the war, Bosnia had no weapons. The weapons we had were mostly obtained superstitiously, or we actually won them from the Serbians on the battlefield. And here, by the way, when we talk about Serbs and Croats, probably one of the most important generals that we had was the Serb general, Jovan Divjak, who prevented the advance of the Serbian militarized, that is, tank forces, down the one valley. There's a long valley that leads into downtown Sarajevo. He was brave. He was a great leader of men and obviously very technically or tactically capable. So, which leads me really to another issue, which is, was this a war against Muslims or was this a war against something else? First of all, it was a war against something much more than Muslims. It was a war against free societies, against diversity. I discovered that I have spoken long about the word tolerance. And the word tolerance doesn't do justice to modern society. Modern society benefits from its diversity because I may not be at all like you on the screen or the LGBTQ person or the Jewish person, the Hindu person or the atheist. But I can learn or I can in some way economically or otherwise benefit from some segments of the society in ways that I would never expect. So that is one of the reasons why a country like the United States has advanced beyond maybe some of its history. Because while on the one side there was a war against tolerance and the free society and diversity, in fact, diversity most of the time won out. And so if we look, for example, the war that the United States recently waged against the virus, it won largely because of so many foreign-born doctors, nurses, many immigrants, many Muslims, many hijabi women who worked courageously. At the same time, while they're being vilified, demonized by this administration. Yeah. So then what was the war? There was something even more dreadful about it, which is relevant to the broader Muslim world. If we look at what happened with South Sudan, East Timor, and several other situations, we can even take the situation of Kashmir.
Yeah.
What many in the Western world were either biased against implicitly or explicitly, they couldn't see that Muslims could lead a Western democratic free society. We somehow couldn't be trusted to be the ones who would be the majority and lead to that society. So we constantly had to fight not against stories about how we committed atrocities, because frankly, there were even very few of those stories. We had so little chance. The stories we had to fight is about how bearded men like you would come in to fight as fundamentalist Muslims, what we called them, about how people like yourselves would come in to wage a religious war. And by the way, sometimes that was a problem for us. People who came in with a Muslim agenda, if you would, they were usually very courageous people, but they also had a Muslim agenda. We did not have a Muslim agenda. Our Muslim agenda was to make sure the Muslims of Bosnia and Herzegovina survived. Because we knew if we survived, our culture, our Islam, and of course, our genetic identity would survive. The Serbs, the ultranationalist Serbs, tried to identify us as really nothing more than Serbs who left the Christian religion long time ago, as Orthodox Christians. Actually, we were all along a distinct group. And even before we were Muslims, we were a distinct heretic, if you would, group of Christians. So we were never part of a greater Serbian Empire or a greater Croatian Empire. There was, in fact, the Bosnian Kingdom 1,000 years ago. 1,000 years ago. And sometimes it was claimed by Catholics and sometimes by Orthodox. But most of the time, it was actually somewhere in between with a unique identity which in many ways resembled many of the Christian identities that were over time erased by either the Western or the Eastern churches.
I mean, there was a lot of stuff repeated by Mladic and Radovan Karadžić and all these guys about the 13th century medieval defeat by the Turks of Serbia and how they came in. And when the UN kind of, or UN peacekeepers...
I think it's time the Muslims go back and take Spain, right? I mean, it's at some point in time, these excuses are so blatantly criminal.
Yeah,
because if you're going to use history as a rationalization, that means you didn't even experience directly the harm or being somehow the loser, not to mention the victim. You have to really dig far back to somehow rationalize your crimes. And for example, let's come to the issue of Black Lives Matter and the issue of whether Black, that is African Americans, deserve reparations. There's a legitimate question whether reparations should be paid to the granddaughters or grandsons of slaves. But one thing we do find out that in fact many of the crimes, or at least the disadvantages and the bigotry, has continued until the modern times. As you're all very young people. I was part of an American football team at my university. It was the first football team to integrate, to allow Black football players. I saw Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X. I saw Martin Luther King. I saw John Lewis. I saw these people in action, and I saw them being assaulted physically and being assaulted in terms of their rights. When we talk about historical rationality, I don't like to go into it. Maybe the closest thing we can come into some historical context is actually something called the Balkan Wars. The Balkan Wars happened around the same time as the so-termed Armenian Genocide. The European Muslims of the Balkans, that was what the Balkan Wars were about. They were being wiped away as Turkey was retreating. And they were being wiped away conveniently because they were Muslims, but the agenda wasn't always religious. Just like we've seen let me just interject this because it ties us to today. The religious right, the evangelical right in America has put up with someone, Donald Trump, who's so vile and who is such a morally flawed person, because it allows some of their religious bigotry to come into force. But do you think Donald Trump is motivated by race or religion? No, he exploits it. And that's what's happened. That's what happened in Bosnia. Milosevic was a former communist, as was Karadzic. They were in effect atheists. And this is what's happened throughout the history, in particularly of the Balkans. I'll let other people speak of other histories. So the most relevant history that comes into play is not a battle that happened 600-700 years ago, because there were many battles and many winners and many losers to many of those battles. But the battle that had some recent relevance was the Balkan Wars, because you could still talk to grandmothers and grandfathers who experienced those, and you could still see the destruction of religious or cultural monuments. You could still see where that used to be my family house, but someone now has taken it over.
I'm just wary of time.
One of the main issues that you had with the Dayton Accords, that you said at the time that it was a bad peace because it still insisted on these ethnic lines and ethnic divides. So I guess what was, at the time, obviously a bad peace was still peace, right? It was still better than war. But later on, we know that you resigned and that you withdrew from the Dayton Accords. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit of the story behind that.
Well, the Dayton Accords, as I alluded to previously, has several flaws in it. It has one major advantage, or I should say two. The first advantage is obvious, which is that peace empowers those who want a more free and open society. And that's what the government represented. We were fighting the fascists. we were fighting those who had anti-European, anti-American ideals, anti-European American values. Okay? So I'm going to interject to you something else. And I say this with pride. When I speak to my Bosnian refugees who live in the United States now, there's growing to be 500,000 almost with children. But there's still many who survived that conflict. And sometimes the children, of course, were born here and they don't understand what father or grandfather or grandmother is talking about. And I said to them, I said, you know, you were Americans before you ever came to America. Why?
Because you were the
grandfather, the mother who came.
Yeah.
Because you were fighting in Bosnia, either as a soldier or as a civilian for those European and American values, those Euro-Atlantic values. And you deserve to be treated as a hero, not a refugee, particularly in Donald Trump's America. And then I used an American phrase which some of you may be familiar with. Thank you for your service. We throw that term around to people who just served in the military. Some of them fought in the U.S. military, some of them not. Sometimes we use that term for police or firefighters. But the people of Bosnia, they actually suffered. They fought. They gave their blood. And they, all, at all times, even when they were defending themselves as Muslims from genocide, they still mostly sought to uphold greater values. Now, you needed to have leadership to remind them of that constantly. As I said, that's the ultra-nationalist Serbian leadership reminded them why they should fear, why they should hate. We reminded them why they should respect, not just tolerate now, but even respect diversity. Because if you look at Sarajevo, it is a Muslim town, but it's not only a Muslim town. And it could not have been all of these combined unless there was not only a tolerance, but a respect, a valuing the nature of this diversity. And most of that happened under Muslim leadership. I must also say here, some of it happened under the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
It's pretty interesting you mentioned Sarajevo, because I visited Sarajevo, I visited the Srebrenica Memorial, and there is a line in Sarajevo, in the town center. I think you go through the town center where the mosque is, and it looks pretty Turkish, it looks pretty Ottoman. And then you get to the middle of the town, and it's literally a line where if you look at one end, it's a very old, traditional, akin to Istanbul sort of look to it. And then you turn around 180 degrees behind you, and you've got the Gucci shops, the Prada shops, the more modern Western feel to the city. And I think we had one of our Bosnian brothers who was with us, and he goes, "This is if you look in that direction, you see the traditional religious side. You look behind you, and you see the more modern Western side. And Sarajevo, sort of an amalgamation of these two identities of Bosnia, where it is a European country, but also largely there is a very large Muslim population to it, and it's a very, very placed in a very unique and strategic.
Well, let me just correct a little bit there. There is a modern part of town and there is an older part of town, but the old synagogue, the old Orthodox church, are built within the old town. The Catholic cathedral is built right on the edge there of the two. And the Catholic, because there aren't that many Catholics in Sarajevo itself, during Christmas, you will have many Muslim vocalists who perform in the choir during Christmas, because there won't be enough Catholics to perform in the choir. And we have a tradition in Bosnia, which, by the way, I had a chance to put on the stage when you two came to Sarajevo in 1997. The show was started by an Islamic choir. And of course there was a couple of other bands, so-called rock bands of mixed ethnicity, and then there was U2 at the end. And what we wanted to make sure the message there was, because I was the organizer of that concert, is that in Sarajevo, everything is permitted on the same stage. And I remember very well that concert where after the what happened as the Islamic choir was the first act that came on stage. And I was behind the stage with the manager of U2, a gentleman named Paul McGuinness, who has since gone into retirement. And when the Islamic choir came out, I could see it was a packed stadium of 60,000 people. And right up front, we call it the mash pit, where usually the most
enthusiastic
are there. And I could smell the marijuana coming from that pit. On the sides of the stadium were peacekeepers from the Western forces, American, British, French, mostly NATO countries that were implementing the peace. We had about 15,000 to 20,000 of them in the stadium on the sides. And they were expecting a rock concert. And they saw this Islamic choir come on. The women in that choir wore the hijab. There were no guitars. That's the tradition. But there were some percussion instruments, and they started performing. And the soldiers on the side started whistling in a derogatory term. People coming, that is, from a part of the world where Islam was foreign to them. And the mash pit heard the whistling and started clapping with the choir and started singing with the choir to reinforce the notion that I might be a rocker, I might be a stoner, but this is also part of me. So implicitly, in Sarajevo, we understand where we came from and where we are. The problem now is where we're going. And this is where the Dayton Agreement comes back in.
Perfect. You've brought us into, you've very, very perfectly brought us into Dayton, which is going to be my, which is going to be my next question, because I know we're wary of the, I'm wary of the time.
No problem. So let me just now say what the problem with Dayton is. Number one, it has stratified the notion of a religious or ethnic hierarchy. So people cannot really look on their neighbor who is not of the same religion and say, what are the shared interests that we have? In effect, you have built a parochial system where you have to look at the top of that hierarchy based upon religion and identify how you advance, not just politically, but economically, socially, in so many ways. So it has become a society like no other Euro-Atlantic society. And it is one that was modeled, of course, not on just on the basis of the preconceptions or bigotry of these Western diplomats, but it was also something that was demanded by the Serbian nationalists. So in effect, they lost the war, but they won the definition of the peace.
Because now, their republic as well. They got their province
and they, the division. And they were, and even though they were, they're facing trial, so many of them, for war crimes, they were not forced to give up any land.
They got what they wanted they off acquired, the back of ethnic cleansing and genocide, essentially.
Exactly. So how is it that they're given the fruits, not of war, but the fruits of war crimes, of genocide? Srebrenica is in the Serb part of the of Serb-dominated part of the country. And the other thing that I always held out for is the notion of that there is really no Dayton II, or to the extent that there is a Dayton II, it was really always intended to be, even by the structure of those documents, the integration of Bosnia into Euro-Atlantic institutions. So the Euro-Atlantic principles would not allow this type of Bosnia to survive. And that's why the Bosnian Muslims in particular want to see Bosnia's integration into Euro-Atlantic institutions. And that's why the Serbian, and even now some Croatian nationalists do not, because, and Putin does not. So Putin, but just like he did not in Ukraine, he doesn't want to see the entry of Ukraine into the EU. He does not want to see Bosnia entry into the EU, not to mention NATO. So
do you think there's a lot of Muslims who feel like if going into, because there's a kind of this argument has happened in Turkey to an extent where they try to compromise.
Forget Turkey. We're not Turkey. And if you as soon as you start to bring Turkey into this discussion, it's like now we are somehow annexes or extended arms of the Ottoman or the Russian empires. We're not. We're in a very unique situation. We are much more connected to you, and you are part of NATO. You were certainly recently part of the EU. I trace an Irish accent, so I can say some of you may still be part of the EU. And certainly the Irish, Northern Irish peace would not have been possible without UK being part of the EU. And we understand why that has become such an issue now in the Brexit talks. And of course, it is exactly this reason why Bosnia's path to the EU and NATO is constantly blocked. It is necessary for others, including some in Turkey, to make Bosnia dance the Ottoman dance. Listen, we've been betrayed in the past by the Ottomans. Yes, we have much in common with the Ottomans. My name has Ottoman elements. My lineage has Ottoman elements. I am more than fine and even proud of that. But the people that I represented and the country that I came from was Bosnia and Herzegovina. My mother, who, by the way, was a medical doctor and has a street named after her in Bosnia, not because of me, but because she was a hero saving Bosnian refugees during World War II. And, by the way, an extremely devout Muslim. She did not wear hijab, but she performed all her fathers or her prayers, for example, five times a day, fasted all the time, taught me my religious studies. She also took me to see Santa Claus and to have Easter eggs painted because she didn't feel threatened by that.
My question from an identity perspective is that people would say that if you look at Bosnians who are so European and so tolerant, and Europe still doesn't accept them, what is it like for an immigrant who comes from a completely different background? If Europe doesn't accept these guys, they're never going to accept someone like me.
That is exactly the question I ask. And that's where you come in. So, for example, there was a point in time after the war that I worked actually with the part of the European political establishment called the Christian Democratic Parties and the Populists, which is the center-right parties. And what they discovered is that at that time, which was 25 years ago, many of their people voting for them were actually Muslims because they believed in family values. They were the more conservative elements of society. And they were eager to actually have Bosnia and this Ali Izetbegović's party become part of the of this grouping. And that was, frankly, I don't want to get into the detail, that was a failing of President Izetbegović. Why? Because we needed to make a connection between you and the Bosnian Muslims in Sarajevo and Zenica and all these other places. Because we needed to make sure that both you and they felt that they were European. So in this sense, I still view it as part of our responsibility towards you. Because my saying in the has been recently, if Europe is not willing to accept us, then why should you feel somehow comfortable? Or to use one of my favorite band's theme songs, Comfortably Numb. Are you just supposed to be comfortably numb with your identity? Or are you supposed to ask questions and be uncomfortable about the inconsistencies? And the inconsistencies are you being asked to be a good British subject. But as you can see at the top, there is some nonetheless failure to accept a place, not to forget about Turkey, a place like Bosnia, as based, and there was a failure on the part of the John Major government to see us as being leaders with a European vision for a diverse Bosnia and Herzegovina. Frankly enough, I had several meetings with Margaret Thatcher at the time. She no longer was prime minister. No, she was much more open-minded. But in part, she was driven actually by an advisor who was a Catholic. And I think that opened her mind to the notion of a much broader Europe.
I wanted to bring that into kind of the work you do on digital diplomacy, as I think we're coming near to the close of this interview. Because it's been, I mean, I think with Bosnia, there's a lot more even to unpack. But some of the stuff you do about digital diplomacy and soft power, what kind of can we do? I think we talked about the challenge we have as not being accepted into the wider society, but also as people who have certain causes that are kind of close to our hearts and we want to make the international community aware of them. What kind of was your experience with Bosnia in raising the profile of the cause and making it relate to the wider audience? But also, how does this apply to things like Kashmir and Idlib and various other causes? So how can we use digital diplomacy and soft power to kind of advocate for these causes?
Yeah, let me start with something I said about 25 plus years ago, which is that we Bosnians, Bosnian Muslims, then in particular Bosniak Muslims, are unfortunate because we're Muslim and therefore bigotry comes into play. But I said we are much more fortunate than people who are farther away.
Are you buying into the kind of idea that Muslims are essentially...
Let me finish the story here. So we are much more unfortunate because we are Bosnian, but we are much more fortunate than the people who are darker, who are further away from Europe, and who may happen to be also non-Christian. So in other words, the closer you are to the center, the more you are viewed as somehow belonging to the human family. To the notion that we use now of global citizen. And, of course, the notion of global citizen is relevant to you because by your appearance and by your religious adherence, you're viewed as being maybe not quite British. And the answer is if you adhere to British and global citizen values, then you should be as much of a citizen of the country where you live because you can contribute to it in ways that the guy who goes to the pub every night may not even be able to anticipate, but the intellectual who can anticipate understands. So, but there are people who are much more unfortunate than you and I, and we owe it to them, and we have a notion of responsibility to at least listen to what's happening. So you and I can't do everything to change the world. We can't be involved in every situation, but I am the coincidental ambassador. And that's another long story. And once you're placed by coincidence, if you wish, the will of Allah or God or Providence into a situation, then you will be in a position to be informed and maybe to help to row the boat or even turn the big ship a little bit. So I feel blessed. It's a mercy of my life. And I think Muslims understand what the word mercy means. It is a mercy of my life that I have been, that many ills have befallen me. But through those ills, I have managed to steer the ship a little bit, and most importantly, to help others who wish to steer the ship. And I don't know who those may be. You may be them. It may be your audience. It may be someone else. So that's an important aspect. But there's another element which I spoke to your group before. And that is a time also that we changed the notion of al-Mu'mineen to incorporate the notion of global citizen. So we are no longer defined by our overt adherence to a religion, but we are defined by a commitment to humankind and to certain norms of fair value, which are in many ways overwhelmingly consistent with Islam and also Euro-Atlantic values. Now, I won't argue with you each one of those elements because that's a discussion once we understand we're all dealing with each other as equals. So that means those people who think they're superior to you because they're born in the UK to parents named Jones or Smith, or to those who you may view in inferior light because they are quote-unquote non-believers. The answer is everyone has a foundation as a human being and deserves that foundation to be developed. And that is a broad thinking that I believe ties your work in diplomacy broader than that. And then I go beyond humankind, which is we Muslims have this unique obligation to say the Bismillah before we kill an animal. Speaking to many imams, including from Bosnia, they will tell you that hunting and fishing are forbidden if they're done for sport, if they're done for pleasure. You can hunt and kill to feed yourself. But if part of your motive is pleasure in killing or even capturing another animal, that is something that is haram, or at least close on the edge of haram. So I spoke to a gentleman from PETA. He was their lawyer. He wanted to ask me because I wrote an article saying, do animals need a UN ambassador or animals global citizens, which are open topics. And it's not necessary that you say yes or no. What's necessary is that you engage, because by engaging, then you help others engage with the issues that are most important to you. That comes again back to your issue of diplomacy. So in this context, if we Muslims believe the life of an animal is not ours, and that's what Gabe said, from PETA said to me, he said, you know, I'm not sure I consider myself a Muslim. He said, the one thing I learned from Islam is that the life of an animal is not humankind's or an individual to basically do with as they wish for pleasure or whatever. It is the life of something bigger than us. And some of the most forward-looking and most active people are people involved in the so-called, there's human rights and human welfare. Either one of those is something that brings us together. So these are ways you open discussions with people in ways that are very consistent with your Islam, but at the same time allow you to broaden your horizons. Because why should most people care about what's going on in Kashmir or Myanmar or Afghanistan or Syria or Bosnia? Sometimes most people only care because, you know, Mo over there, he looks like an American, so those Bosnians must be good guys. I mean, that was a lot of my diplomacy, and I understood it. It's crude. It's in many ways even antithetical to who I am, but I understood it, and one had to employ it.
I think the whole concept of global citizenship and that notion is very, very important in Islam and in our religion, because we are taught not just to stand up for Muslims or stand up for the people of the same skin color, whereas we're taught to stand up for all mankind. I think in the Quran, in itself, the Prophet, it says in the Quran that the Prophet was sent as a mercy to mankind, not a mercy to Arabs, not a mercy to Muslims, but rather a mercy to mankind. And to conclude, we draw it back to a point where Ali, one of the companions of the Prophet and the fourth of the rightly guided Khalifas, he has a saying, says, whoever isn't your brother in faith is your brother in humanity. So I think this notion of global citizenship, we as Muslims should naturally identify with it, because that's what we're taught. That's what we're brought up with. I think it's been a very, very, very insightful discussion, a very eye opening discussion with you, Ambassador, and we'd love to have you. We'd love to have you back at your earliest convenience. So when you have time to further unpack the sort of plethora of topics that we've discussed today, thank you for your time. I know there is a sort of a time difference in the States where you are, and you're incredibly busy. So thank you for your time. Thank you for the lessons and for the takes that we've had to take. And
I think the first suggestion, sorry, that the ambassador had was about a book that he was going to recommend to all our listeners.
Yes. Yes. So before we wrap up,
I actually feel negligent in two ways. So you will excuse me. First of all, it's a book by a gentleman called Tom Osborne, UN correspondent, called Genocide for Beginners, which speaks much of the background that was occurring at the UN, particularly as it relates to the genocide in Bosnia and Herzegovina. As I mentioned to you, Tom is not a Muslim. Tom is LGBTQ. So he would be someone who would not naturally tend to write stories about conspiracies against Muslims. But in fact, what we find is sometimes there are small conspiracies that evolve out of huge bigotries. And these bigotries sometimes are overt and sometimes they are implicit. The second point I would make is I actually haven't finished the story of how Srebrenica was betrayed. And it was not just an implicit betrayal, it was an explicit betrayal. In effect, the deal that I speculated from almost the very fall of Srebrenica was made by the big powers not to confront Serbian forces if they entered Srebrenica and the other enclaves. So it was not only Srebrenica, there was another smaller enclave, Zepa, which we managed to evacuate mostly, that was given up. And several other of the enclaves were on the menu, for lack of a better word, except that the Serbians did such a horrendous job in committing murders and genocide in Srebrenica that it had to stop before the menu could be fully exhausted. And the reason this was allowed to happen is because we were offered a map a year earlier, which included places like Srebrenica and this town, Zepa, and several others, to be included in the Bosnian Croat-dominated part of the country. And we accepted that map. The Serbian side refused that map. And when we were then told, well, we should make a trade to make it more, to allow the Serbians to accept trade territory, something that's discussed frequently now, including around Kosovo, we refused because we did not wish to be trading land within our own country because it was all of our country. And we did not wish to be trading the land of private people. So in effect, the Serbian forces were given what I call the yellow signal, now it looks more like a green signal, to be able to take over these enclaves. So the NATO defense minister called me up the night before Srebrenica fell, and he said, I've asked for NATO airstrikes to stop the Serbian advance because they saw it coming, gradually creeping in. And those airstrikes never came. The NATO, what we found out afterwards in a UN report, is that NATO was sent 7 to 8 signals. We're not sure if it was 7 or 8 different signals for help. And none of those signals were ever replied to, not even a no. There was never a yes or no, we're coming. There was no reply. So Srebrenica was allowed to fall. And this was a betrayal of NATO as well, because NATO did not know about this deal. And NATO did not know why it was not responding. This deal was played at the very highest level. It was played at the level of a couple of French generals, of Holbrooke, of Mitterrand, of a couple of the British leaders, including, I believe, Major. And as a consequence, they bear the responsibility for what happened. We can argue about whether they could foresee the consequences, but they, in fact, betrayed their responsibility, both as NATO and as UN, to protect that enclave and arouse the murder of these people. For a long time, this whole vision or this whole so-called conspiracy theory was rejected. It's not true. And then about 4-5 years ago, the main Dutch television station, NTV, and The Guardian did their own, they went into the Clinton Library and looked through the documents, and they interviewed Holbrooke's widow, Kati Martin.
Yeah.
And they all confirmed that, in fact, there was a deal. Now, Holbrooke's widow argues that Holbrooke was against it. But all I know is that Holbrooke kept quiet. quiet through it and then helped execute.
Apparently he was on the way to his honeymoon trying to stop it from happening, and
exactly. So this is the reason why I was in many ways pushed into very difficult situation, which I don't need to get into. But in fact, what turned out to be one of these can't be real conspiracy theories turned out to be. And I'm not a believer in conspiracy theories, but in this one instance, there really was a conspiracy. The conspiracy may have been one of inaction, by which someone like Mladic then could take action. But as because the defenders were themselves denied weapons to defend themselves, and because the peacekeepers were themselves, in effect, made impotent, and because the UN and NATO were never informed of this deal, this was a conspiracy in its truest terms.
And so this is Genocide for Beginners by David Wayne Canervo.
This is Tom Osborne and Dr. David.
Tom Osborne.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tom Osborne is the UN person that was there when this was all occurring. He was there representing ABC News, obviously a very important American outlet. And it's my fortune or misfortune, I was at the UN most of the time before the internet age. So you will find some things on the internet about my work there and so on. But most of it happened before the internet age. On the other hand, as you were little children at that time, or maybe not yet born, I was very present at that time on CNN and BBC and Deutsche Welle and Middle East Broadcast and so many other of
all the major outlets.
Major outlets speaking of these things. So there was a much greater focus on what was going on in Bosnia, because we can say that the media right now is much more dispersed.
Yeah,
of course. Well, thanks again for your time, Ambassador. Thanks to coin a phrase that you mentioned to us. Thanks for your service. The work that you've done on Bosnia and Herzegovina, the work you've done on digital diplomacy is fantastic work. And again, once again, we'd like to thank you for being with us. Thank you for taking time out of your day to speak to us, to speak to our listeners, to our listeners. Thanks for listening. This brings us to the end of our episode. If you've got any feedback or if you've got any questions, you can email us at podcast@themiddlewest.co.uk. You can also follow us on our social media at The Middle West PC on Facebook and Twitter, and at The Middle West Podcast on Instagram. And we look forward to being with you on another episode, hopefully sometime soon. And thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you.